Resources Committee meeting in order, and we have several bills before us today. We're also going to hear Commissioner Gallagher. The first item that we have before us is Senate Joint Resolution Number 53, commending the United States Coast Guard.
Commending the Coast Guard? Commending.
It's really kind of a thank you resolution.
Intrepidity. Intrepidity? Whose word is that? Is that what that is? You have to say, too.
You've heard the motion. Are there any objections? So moved.
Mess around here. Now, you guys in the House side, we'll spend a half an hour debating that.
We were here by that.
Well, we were in charge. We didn't do those kind of things. We had to. Don't read it, it's sorry.
I did it all on purpose.
Yeah, I got it back down at the city goodbye.
Our next item of business is Senate Bill 14. This is Senator Arsenio Gil on agriculture. I'd like to ask him to start out by giving us a discussion of it. He's going to bring it in. Mr. Farley is going to make copies of the committee substitute.
Yeah. Madam Chairman, I've passed out to committee members a packet of support for the bill. They come from various sources. The basic need for the, well, in the packet is a sort of a summary of backup for the bill. The second page is an indication of value of Alaska's agricultural potential. The third is a article appearing in the Anchorage Times, and in particular note the hunger that exists in the world. The fourth is also a different article from the Anchorage Times, looking at the world agricultural situation. The fifth is an article from the New York Times, in particular pertaining to action taken by the state of California with respect to agricultural land. And the last one is an editorial in the Anchorage Times a year ago, again looking at the world food situation. Basically, what we're looking at is a world that is hungry, and is increasingly so, and expected to be increasingly so in the future. There's a real problem with increasing population, which is certainly beyond the scope of this legislature to address. The population is expected to double in about 30 to 35 years, in particular in those nations in Asia, Africa, and South America. The U.S., United States, has been the major exporter of world food in the world, and there are some statistics there on the amount of the world's food exports that the United States supplies in 1971. Effects of food prices and how they can have national and international effects is the 1973 Alaska fishermen, of course, prospered by increasing value of fish, but also 1973 United States as a whole had some problems with food prices due to the United States sale of wheat to Russia. Looking at the state of Alaska, a couple of things are significant to note. Alaska has about 1% of the world's agricultural land. We don't think of ourselves, I don't think, as a major agricultural state, but that's considering what portion of the world Alaska is, that's not too bad. The bill contains less than 3% of the land that the state will eventually select, probably more likely in the order of 2%. So we're not talking about a major portion of the state selection in this bill, but obviously we're talking about particular portions of state selection. Agricultural products that are capable of being produced in Alaska that we know of at this time are oats, barley, forage crops, vegetables, small fruits, etc. And research is an ongoing process, and new methods of raising crops in particular are being addressed. The main impetus for the bill is the irreversibility of land use. We can take agricultural land and turn it into subdivisions sometime in the future. But taking subdivided land and turning it into agricultural land just doesn't work out. And that's the problem that the bill is addressing. This is basically, at least the first part of the bill is basically the same piece of legislation that passed the legislature 2 years ago and was vetoed by Governor Egan at that time. It would take 80% of the agricultural land, state-owned agricultural land, and put it into an agricultural use classification. And it's not a hard and fast classification. It could be this land, this 80%, could be eventually taken out of that classification if for some reason in the future small pieces or large pieces of it were determined to be better suited to other uses. But it does make it a reasonably difficult process, and that's the intention, is to make it a reasonably difficult process. That's all the original bill really did. It provided for this classification of the land, of agricultural land, and the means by which the land would be both classified and potentially unclassified or declassified. After discussion, a committee substitute has been prepared, which changes the wording a bit to clarify the intent. It doesn't change the substance of the bill any, but it does make it a little bit more clear really what the intent of the legislation is. And then it adds section 2, 3, and 4 are taken from the governor's House bill on dealing with state land, Title 38, same title. The House bill is more comprehensive. It addresses many types of state land, not just agricultural land. These sections 2, 3, and 4 are those sections of that bill that have been taken verbatim out of that bill and put in as part of this bill to really make this bill now a comprehensive approach to state land, the first part of which is the classification process, and the other sections keep the classification intact. As we know now that the classification process isn't a terribly strong process. Natural resources could classify the land as almost anything and sell the land to private individuals or lease it or whatever, or and not leases so much, but the sale of land. A year after the sale, the land is, the classification is really no longer binding. So a person could purchase from the state at a low price agricultural land, and a year later subdivide it for other uses. I was never able to figure it out, frankly. The commissioner, then Commissioner of Natural Resources, testified in favor of the bill. It passed the legislature fairly handily in both houses. There were probably 75 or 80% in favor. And the first thing I knew after the session was over, the bill had been vetoed. There was a veto message along with the bill, and I could never figure out what the reason was, frankly. Madam Chairman, that's as a professional planner myself, this is obviously not a comprehensive planning approach. But agriculture has been kicked around so much in the last, I don't know how many years, that it's going to be wait some more for some more time and more consideration and more studying and on, it's never going to get done. So this is perhaps it's an unplanning approach, but. I think the use is important enough to do it that way. Each year, another piece of agricultural land goes into non-agricultural uses. If you look at that article from the New York Times, there, California has been considering the problem that we're having now in the Matanuska Valley and other places in the state of good agricultural land being used for non-agricultural uses, subdivided and going to other uses. California, as a number of years ago, tried to stop this by enacting legislation very similar to what we now have on the books of a tax preference. And simply the tax preference approach just doesn't work. It'll slow things down as far as the development of non-agricultural land or agricultural land into non-agricultural uses. It slows it down, but it doesn't stop it. California is now taking a much more heavy-handed approach, in that it would put all prime agricultural land under control of the state commission. Now, this is, I think, a much more heavy-handed step than we would like to see taken here in the state of Alaska. But California thinks it's necessary because the Williamson Act that they have had for a number of years just hasn't worked. To really stop this erosion of agricultural land. And I would hope that perhaps by taking this action, the state of Alaska could avoid in the future doing something that that California seems to think is important to do now.
Madam Chairman, good evening. Senator Cena, you certainly have my full support on legislation of this being an old farm boy from Forestville, Iowa. I'm very interested in the use of agricultural land. I'm wondering on
Madam Chairman, Senator Meland, on the wall here is a map of Alaska's agricultural potential, and I had nothing to do with that map, but it indicates that Southeast Alaska doesn't seem to have much agricultural potential, at least with respect to crops. I would be more than happy to take your word for it. I would urge you to contact the Soil Conservation Service and inform them of your feelings and see if they can.
That's all. Thank you.
Any Madam Chairman, I'd like to address the planning question that was raised. I don't think the state can or should try and plan for all the state land we have. We should obviously plan for those areas near cities that are going to be heavily inhabited, but we shouldn't worry about trying to plan for every single acre of land the state owns. It's not reasonable, it's not feasible, and probably isn't in the best interest of the state. Things do change. Naming it as agricultural land should be sufficient rather than trying to plan its use for the next 100 years.
Madam Chairman, I would like to again reiterate, we're not talking about irreversible uses. If 10 years from now we find that really agriculture isn't the thing that Alaska wants to get into, that some of our predictions and projections are not, things aren't as bleak as they seem at the point now, we can always take this agricultural land, which certainly not all of that at that time is going to be in plowed under. But even if it was, we could put it to other uses. We're not talking about an irreversible process. The irreversibility is the other way, where you subdivide it into half-acre lots and sell it, and people build homes on it, and then that's the end of the agricultural use. So we're not preventing the future use of the same land that we're now classifying as agricultural from going into other uses in sometime 10, 20 years in the future. I have no objection if somebody wants to testify, but I didn't call anybody to testify. Most of the people, particularly in the Senate, have been through this 2 years ago, so I think the House will take a longer look at it, since most of them haven't been heard last week.
It does have a further referral to Commerce?
Yes, it does.
Madam Chairman, can we see how many due passes we have, and then maybe you'll... Thank you. Relating to the acquisition of oil and gas leasehold interest in Hatchback Bay and providing for an effective date.
you care to...
If there's somebody else wants to testify, I'm still writing notes.
Okay.
We were a little late upstairs, and I'm still talking on an empty stomach.
For the record, my name is Bob Palmer, Senator Pullman, members of the committee. I have a presentation of maybe 10 or 15 minutes here. I understand the constraints that you're working under. I understand you have some other measures that you feel may have some importance that you'd like to get to. So rather than go through this presentation, I would simply state that the administration would be very happy to be able to resolve the Kachemak Bay conflict that now exists through negotiation with the industry. We therefore support the concept of this bill. We do feel, however, that along with the authority to negotiate, it is reasonable and desirable for the legislature to impose a moratorium for a specified period of time on drilling activities on the existing leases while those negotiations are going forward. And I think unless there are questions, why that would be the extent of my comments.
Any questions at this moment?
Okay, I have one with regard to that last point. I've never had a chance to examine Senator Palmer, and I wanted to do that for no other reason, because he was chairman of this committee at one point, as I recall. But I'm curious what the exposure of the state would be, what authority, say, the legislature has to impose a moratorium on any activity under a validly existing lease, assuming the Supreme Court decides that the lease was validly issued, and I assume you wouldn't need the moratorium if the court decided otherwise. What authority does the legislature have to do that? And secondly, what liability does the state insurer to do it?
You did what?
I was just curious if the administration has had a chance to analyze that aspect.
Senator, no, quite frankly, it's not. This matter came up very late this morning, and this seemed like a reasonable conclusion. Assuming that it is something that legally can be done without undue exposure by the state, and something talked over with the governor to some extent. But again, it was all, the whole thing is very brief. So, if after due deliberation by the committee, it seemed that there would not be an undue exposure, then philosophically it would be a highly desirable addition to the bill. Yeah, this is quite a change, isn't it? First time this happened, maybe not the last. Senator, you know that's not necessary.
Thank you.
Future oil development and the protection of the marine
life in the bay, which is a very important resource for that area. On March the 22nd, we had a one-day hearing on House Bill, or sponsor substitute for House Bill 626, in which some people from the Homer area, principally representatives of the fishing industry, testified on this bill. And their fears, as I got from the testimony, were the drilling in the bay, where the leases are, they were fear of what damage it might do to the crab industry. Also, the cash cost of buying back these leases. And they also had a fear, and this also includes Seldovia, which is a primarily a fishing community. They had a fear of establishment of a sanctuary or a park system. They don't think it's necessary, and I will go along with that thinking. I think this bill that you have before you will solve many problems that now exist in the Kachemak Bay area. Now, where the oil companies would be willing to go along with this, not simply because they do have some valid leases at this date, I wouldn't have any idea. But I do know that this bill, if it could be, if it is valid and if it's constitutional and so forth, it would be, I think, the answer to a big problem down there. If Mr. Representative Smith and I have been assigned by Chairman Anderson to rewrite the bill for the third time, and he is working on a rough draft of which he showed me, which we essentially make a park out of the Kachemak Bay area, and I'm sure that this is something that people don't want, and I think the people really should have a voice in it. My version of the answer to this problem actually lies in Senate Bill 720. That's all the testimony I have.
Thank you, Representative Rhodes. Senator Orsini?
Leo, I guess I'm confused here. I thought you started off by saying that the existing critical habitat area is sufficient protection for any problems. Then you sort of wind up by saying that we should go back and reacquire the original bonuses and plus expenses, no. Et cetera, et cetera.
No, well, the habitat area, I think, is sufficient protection for future drilling, for future activity in the bay, and controlling the marine resources. No, not solving the lease sale. The lease sale would be solved either in the court, Supreme Court, or possibly could be solved by this bill or by condemnation. And the previous bills of House Bill 626 and the sponsor substitute did have a condemnation in it. And this was very, very much opposed by many, many people. I have a few.
Well, okay. What I guess I'm still unclear as to what we're doing then. Is drilling for oil in Kachemak Bay with the existing protection we have because it's critical habitat area a safe thing to do or not a safe thing to do?
Well, under Senate Bill 720, there would be no future leases sold, as I understand the bill.
Okay, then what about existing?
But these leases, the habitat area was formed after the leases were sold.
So the leases have a prior right then to
yes.
do whatever they want to do?
This is, except it's in court. It was taken to court, the validity of the leases.
Okay, then as I understand it, if we were to repurchase the existing leases and then sell new leases, and you would be satisfied that there would be sufficient protection?
There would be no leases sold in the bay, no. I am satisfied with that.
There would be no leases sold. So there'd be no
within the habitat area, which extends, I believe in the description on here, is 3 miles outside of the bay, the state limit, 3 miles.
I guess what I need is a map showing where the different areas are, because I can't envision them.
Yeah, if I could send over and get a map. I have it in my office.
Well, maybe the rest of the committee is more familiar with this area than I am. I don't know, but I can't envision where the areas of concern are particularly.
You got one right in here. That's fine. I have one on my wall. I should have brought it over, I guess, but that was such a rush between the time we returned up there and getting over here. I couldn't get my material together. I feel, Madam Chairman, while they're getting the map, I feel that the habitat area does offer sufficient protection for any future oil activity in the bay. For this, I'd like to read into the record a letter received from Daniel Hennick, H-E-N-N-I-C-K, a marine biologist consultant in Homer at the present time. It starts out, "Dear Representative Rode," I don't know the man at all.
I do.
Do you know him?
Yeah.
"By way of introduction, I feel I should inform you that I am a professional marine research biologist. I am a former Alaska Fish and Game employee, 14 years, and between 1968 through 1974, I was in charge of shellfish investigations for the Cook Inlet area. Since state employment, among other endeavors, I have become self-employed as a marine biologist consultant. During my state employment, I was instrumental in creating the Kachemak Bay Critical Habitat Area. My feelings were, and still are, that the critical habitat designation was needed in order for the state of Alaska to have a method to close control of any development of the non-renewable resources of the area. Since 1974, this has been a reality, and the state now has the means of control of petroleum-related activities. Permits issued for exploration or production drilling can and should contain stipulations of control. Under this means of control, the Fish and Game, the State Department of Fish and Game has direct input as advisors, semicolon, out of the political arena where they have no business being. Under SSHB 626, the Department of Fish and Game will be given direct control and as such subject to great and not subject to great political intervention. We have already seen examples of this at the various meetings held in Homer. There has been far too much involvement of a personal nature by highly biased fish and game officials. There has been release of preliminary unpublished biological data many times as an underhanded manner circumnavigating state regulations governing such releases. Once such non-factual bias information is released to the press, in whatever manner, it immediately is picked up by opposition groups and created as a biological fact. How easy it is for a biased state employee receiving high salary to play foul ball in the name of doing their job. I do not want," and in quote, in brackets, "and I am certain many others still agree, the many individuals in this category make rash decisions which in the long run deny me my means of livelihood. Passage of Senate sponsor substitute for House Bill 626 would in fact accomplish this. I believe oil and gas development can be compatible if proper controls is implemented with the renewable resources and associated activities thereof. We need development in order to generate revenues and jobs. There has been no growth in the fishing industry, and I foresee none of many consequences in the future. We have here an example of minority rule having long-range effect upon the state and the citizens of Kachemak Bay region. If and when the time comes to allow the state to buy back condemned leases, I am sure the majority will be loudly heard, but it will be too late to do anything. The loss of jobs and revenue will be catastrophic. My main theme is that SSHB 626 is unnecessary legislation to protect Kachemak Bay, as means of adequate control now exist. How unfortunate it will be if the Outer Continental Shelf leases are let under federal sponsorship and control, leaving the state with little or no control. The threat to the environment is as great or even greater offshore than inshore. Legislation designed to prohibit oil development inshore does not solve the problem by certain vents. I urge you to continue your investigation and the need of validity of SSHB 626 and do whatever you can to prevent its passage. It's signed by Daniel Henry. This is the map. Here's the bay, here's the Homer Spit. Now here's the this doesn't give where the drilling is. One of them is outside of the Shell's, I believe Shell's permit is outside of the habitat area that was created. Here it is. There it is. This one is outside of it. But I think under Senate Bill 720, it goes out 3 miles offshore, does it not? Which would put it out, clear out.
Yes.
So under that bill, there would be no drilling. And then I believe the federal government in their lease sales has withdrawn another 12 miles. I think they've taken out 12 miles from the bay out so that it wouldn't even be near the bay. Yeah, this shows it a little bit more. It's a little more in color. I have no more testimony, Madam Chairman. Is there any questions on it? Certainly let me try and answer them.
Thank you. Are there further questions of Representative Rowland? Senator Rossini?
Is your opinion then, Leo, that all the existing environmental conservation, et cetera, regulations that we have and laws are not sufficient to protect the fish and crab in the bay?
I think
currently,
they are.
Currently.
I think they are currently, yes, with the habitat area there has been established after the leases were sold.
But certainly, don't those who have the leases still have to follow the state law on this kind of thing? Why are they have a blank check to do anything they wish in that area because they had a lease
prior to 74? I presume in the permits for let there was very strict stipulations put on the drilling. But a group of people in Homer, whom I know of one just through, we'll say, a newspaper association, that brought suit against the state and the oil companies over the validity of the leases. And that's what's in the Supreme Court now. But since that time is when the critical habitat area was formed. So now they do have sufficient control as this biologist. States.
But then why do we have to buy back the lease if there's control?
We really don't have to buy. I don't think we have to buy them back, really. But if the court decision would probably have some determination on that. But maybe the oil companies don't want to sell them back. I don't know. But this,
imagine if we offer
this
enough
bill,
the bill, yeah.
This bill, well, there's a limit, I think, in that bill. There's a, this bill will authorize in negotiation to try and get them back. This is the reason that I favor the bill. I don't like condemnation. I wouldn't vote for a condemnation bill. I don't know what it was. I just don't believe in it. I don't believe in condemning people's property unless it's for health or safety.
Madam Chairman, do we have a future witness who with some expertise on fish in the area? I'm still not convinced that it's really a problem, I guess, is what it amounts to.
Well, all this bill does, Senator Orsini, did you read the sheet of what it's intended to do? Or?
Yeah, but I want to know why we're going to spend over $30 million of the taxpayers' money, or equivalent, a loss of revenue if we're not going to spend it out of pocket, to buy back leases. Certainly the people I represent are going to be affected by that loss of $30 million. And no. Like any other expenditure, they have every right to ask me why we're spending that money. I don't know. I can't tell them now.
Well, it doesn't authorize that. It just says that negotiations can be
okay, they're going to ask me why we're even negotiating, and I can't tell them the answer to that.
Madam Chairman, are you talking about with regard to the biological reasons?
That's right.
I think the House Resources Committee, the chairman's here, and certainly Leo sat through a lot of those hearings. There were rather extensive testimony in that regard as to both the crab and the shrimp breeding that takes place in the Ketchikan Bay area, and that was the concern from the Department of Fish and Game in regard to that aspect of it.
And our existing laws aren't sufficient to protect this crab and fish there.
Well, I'm sure there are stipulations with which the companies have to comply in that area. The question is, even if the companies complied with all the stipulations, what potential for harm is there? You know, even granted that there's full compliance.
Yeah, I agree with you. We're not talking about, you talk about fish, you talk about oil. I agree that we're not talking about cohabitation, we're talking about coexistence. And my personal feeling is that they can coexist. But I'm not a biologist. I don't know what damage could be done. You do have accidents, I'm sure. But the basic fact that there's 13 wells been drilling up Cook Inlet, where conditions are far more severe than they are in Ketchikan Bay for some 10, 12 years, is an indication to me that the oil companies have been pretty careful.
Mr. Palmer, did you wish to?
Mr. or Madam Chairman, maybe I should reevaluate the position and present at least a portion of this then and try to answer some of the questions that the Senator has brought up, if you have no objections.
Go ahead.
Madam Chairman, I was a senator from that area at the time of the lease sale, and also chairman of the Special Senate Fisheries Committee. And after the sale, and at the request of the people of Homer and Seldovia, I think you will remember, you were a member of that committee also, we held extensive hearings both in Homer and in Juneau on this matter. While I've always felt and many times stated that the oil industry and the fishing industry can be, and now are, compatible in Upper Cook Inlet, as a result of those hearings that we held, both in Homer and in Juneau, I became completely convinced that the opposite is true in Ketchikan Bay. The risks in Ketchikan Bay are simply too great, the shellfish resource too vulnerable, to make the gamble worthwhile. And let me share with you some of the reasons for my conclusion. Ketchikan Bay contains only 2.8% of the waters of Cook Inlet and the Southern District, and yet it produces 62% of the shellfish harvest in dollars. Per unit volume, it is one of the most productive, if not the most productive, bodies of water in the world. In 1973, the fishery products worth $7.3 million, first wholesale value, were harvested from Ketchikan Bay. And this is, of course, a renewable resource and will, if properly protected, continue to produce for generations to come. 65% of all the shellfish, shrimp and crab, produced in Lower Cook Inlet and in Ketchikan Bay apparently originate in a giant whirlpool area near Bluff Point in Ketchikan Bay, where the adults concentrate to shed their larvae. And these larvae are then distributed by the tides and currents to the rest of the bay and the lower inlet. And this is the exact area where the oil leases and the drilling permits were issued. Oil company officials have stated they cannot develop those leases with offset or whipstock drilling from outside the leased area. When shellfish larvae are shed by the female, they are microscopic in size. Many of them float to the surface, and they remain there for as much as 4 months on the surface. The National Marine Fisheries Service has just completed research showing that as little as 3/10 of one part oil per million parts water is toxic to some stages of shellfish larvae. They found that 3 parts oil per million parts water was toxic to all stages of the shellfish larvae. And yet the Coast Guard, in our hearings on dirty ballast some years ago, said to us, and Lieutenant Nodine of the Coast Guard here in Juneau has confirmed that very recently, their statement was that less than 10 to 15 parts oil per million parts water does not even produce a visible sheen on the water. Therefore, it is entirely possible that because of small leaks in the piping system, defective valves, we just had one that lost, I think, 10,000 gallons of fuel in Trading Bay very recently, a defective valve. Anyway, it's quite possible that because of small leaks in the piping system, defective valves, or poor housekeeping measures occurring on or near the platforms placed directly in this whirlpool area, small quantities of oil could be continuously going into those whirlpool waters. Now, the concentration of oil in the water might be small enough, 10 parts per million or less, to be invisible, and yet great enough, 3 parts per million or more, to kill all the shellfish larvae present. It's very possible that no one would know the kill was even occurring until the crab and shrimp resources simply disappeared or that year's class simply did not come back. There will be a great deal of development for Homer and Seldovia in the Lower Kenai Peninsula from the federal oil and gas lease sales in Lower Cook Inlet. That's going to occur anyway. Anyone wishing for a boom economy for that area apparently will get it, regardless of what happens in Kachemak Bay as far as oil leases are concerned there. It seems most responsible in considering jobs for tomorrow as well as today to plan for immediate oil development from those federal lands in Lower Cook while reserving Kachemak Bay for the tourist and fishing industries. This would allow Alaskans to enjoy the benefits of all three types of industry rather than taking the unwarranted gamble of severe loss or destruction to the fishery while simply enlarging, not extending, the oil boom. Let me share with you, if I may, 3 pages of the appellate brief that was filed in this court suit detailing the history of the sale, because we believe that not only should the bay never have been leased, but the manner in which it was done, the denial of a free people of their opportunity to be heard in a case like this, the denial of those people of that right is really appalling, and this history summarizes that. The first reference in the record to a proposed Kachemak Bay oil and gas lease sale, appears in the form of a press release from the office of former Governor William Egan, published April 13 of 1972. This announcement brought early expressions of concern from the Homer Chamber of Commerce. These letters to members of the executive branch brought a response from the director of the Division of Lands, Mr. Frank Keenan, to the effect that a potential lease sale in Kachemak Bay was rather remote and speculative. He stated that the state did not even expect to request nominations for this area until late in 73. Moreover, he stated it was, quote, possible that we will not receive any requests to offer the offshore lands. It is thus very difficult to speculate at this point whether there will be a sale in the area, and if there is, what effect it will have on the economy of the area. Many areas are leased on which there is never any drilling or exploration activities, and even when there is such activity, it often results in dry holes and no further development. End of quote. The Chamber of Commerce of Homer nevertheless extended an invitation to the director to discuss the situation in more detail. Pedro Denton, chief of the minerals section of the Division of Lands, spoke to the Homer Chamber of Commerce in the fall of 72 and discussed the state's oil and gas leasing program generally. Denton told the Chamber of Commerce that industry interest in Kachemak Bay would very likely be slight, and thus, as a practical matter, there was very little to worry about. The agency affirmed these reassurances via letters from Denton's offices, dated several times through March and April and August. The call for nominations from the oil industry was issued on July 13 of 73. The nominating period closed September 4 of 73. 2 weeks after the close of nominations, a recommendation was made by Denton to Charles Herbert, then Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources, to include a large part of Kachemak Bay in the oil and gas lease sale. The record indicates that this recommendation was made without the benefit of public hearings, studies, or consultations with other interested agencies. Herbert reviewed Denton's recommendation with petroleum and geological experts within the Department of Natural Resources. And after briefly discussing the matter with Governor Egan, Herbert gave his approval for the sale. After the determination was made to include Ketchmack Bay within the lease sale, a memo went out to the Department of Fish and Game so advising that agency. This memo, dated October 22, 1973, stated that the Division of Lands, quote, would appreciate your review and comment. Such review was needed immediately as, quote, we will need to publish actual sale tracts and sale conditions in the first full week of November. Yet this is dated October 22nd. The memo ended with an apology for the short time requirements, but made it clear that the decision as to which area to offer had already been made. Quote, we apologize for the short time, but due to a communication problem in our department, we were very late in deciding which area to offer. On October 23rd, 1973, one day following the memo to the Department of Fish and Game, notice of the sale was given to the petroleum industry. The notice stated that the sale will include the area shown on the attached map. The map made it clear that this was to include a sale of leases in Ketchmack Bay. October 23rd, this notice went out to the oil industry. Also on October 23rd of 73, a memo from the Anchorage Office of the Department of Fish and Game distributed Denton's October 22nd request for comments within the department. It stated in part, quote, it's another rush deal, so I would like any comments you may have by October 30th, if possible. Senator Poland, I believe you will recall that in our hearings we heard testimony from the people on the scene in Homer, ADF and G, that they had 2 days in which to do the examinations and do the studies, consult with one another, and recommend stipulations that should be included in those leases. 2 days. On November 8, 73, the Anchorage Office of the Department of Fish and Game forwarded the staff recommendation concerning the sale to the Juneau Office of the Department, and so on. I guess that's the end of it. If I may, I would like to share with you 3 letters from people in Homer, and they're no more than one page. This letter is from Jesse Nelson, Box 793 of Homer, to Governor Egan, dated November 16. November 16. As residents of Homer, which is situated on Ketchmack Bay, we are very interested in the areas to be open for lease to oil exploration. It is understood that the Lower Cook Inlet area is to be up for lease very soon, and no mention has been made of omitting the waters of Ketchmack Bay proper from exploration. Many people, including ourselves, obtain our livelihood from these waters, and I believe the building of platforms would be detrimental. The platforms themselves are not the primary factor, but all the supply boats that would be operating in the area would raise havoc with king crab pots, shrimp pots, tanner crab pots, dungeness crab pots, halibut lines, etc. Needless to mention, the platforms would do much to destroy the beauty of this area and our tourist industry. I'm sure you are aware of this as you have visited here. We are suggesting an abstention line be drawn from Anchor Point to Point Beatty, and no oil exploration be allowed north of this line. We will accept the influence of the oil people on our town for their activities in Lower Cook and Kamishak Bay with more enthusiasm if our beloved Ketchmack Bay is preserved. Kamishak Bay is across Cook Inlet on the far side. Please consider your fellow Alaskans and why we live here. I realize oil is important to the U.S., but I can't believe one bay will make that much difference to the whole country, whereas it will make a tremendous difference for us. Many people come to Homer to view its unspoiled beauty. Please help us keep it that way. Sincerely, Jesse Nelson. The governor's reply, dated November 23rd now, says this, and I suspect that, as in our administration, many of these replies are formulated by the department heads directly involved for the governor's signature. I'm only speculating, but I suspect that's what happened. Dear Ms. Nelson, the deep feelings, respect for, and admiration of Alaska's natural environment expressed in your letter to me are shared by almost every citizen of our beautiful state. Having spent my entire lifetime in Alaska and traveling often to every part of your state, you may be sure that my appreciation for Alaska and this way of life equals yours. In the course of Alaska's development, it has always been my intention to strive for a balance between the extraction of our vitally needed natural resources and the preservation of our scenic areas and our wildlife. You may be sure that it will continue to be the state's policy to see that compatible development takes place. The important paragraph. The Ketchmack Bay area of Alaska is indeed one of the most beautiful in our state. Should development near the bay be contemplated, you may rest assured that it will be given extremely close scrutiny by the public and by Alaska's governmental representatives. Now, this letter from the governor to these people is dated November 23rd. 1 month earlier than this, the industry has already been notified that the lease sale will go forward and it will include these waters in Ketchikan Bay. The exact same letter went to Ms. Nancy Boyle in Homer on that same date. There are some others. I will not take your time to read them. The natural assumption, well, let me go back. Homer, as you know, it's a small place, and this assurance of the governor, as contained in those letters, was widely circulated, and it was believed. The natural assumption then, when people in Homer finally became aware of the plans to offer leases in Ketchikan Bay, was that hearings would be held in Homer prior to the sale. And as the December 13 sale date drew near, and the assurances seemed to be either forgotten or construed much differently by the department than by the people of Homer, then another step was taken. Approximately 308 people signed a petition to the Department of Natural Resources, again requesting a hearing in Homer prior to a sale, pleading that someone listen to their concerns and share with them the state's plan for their community before those plans had proceeded so far that change was impractical, if not impossible. And yet that final plea was denied. That request by approximately 300 people, and that their government simply sit down and talk with them before such momentous and irreversible changes were set in motion, was turned down. Even though the state had found time and money for one of its officials to travel to Homer and talk with a few selected people, the Department of Natural Resources had been unwilling to have that official meet in the open with all the people concerned and give them an opportunity to voice those concerns. And so finally, the last step prior to the sale was taken by the people of the area. A telegram was sent to Joe Keenan to put all parties on notice that the legality of the sale was now in question. And that telegram said this. It's addressed to him. The text says, I urge you to carefully consider your decision not to hold public hearings prior to sale of Ketchikan Bay oil leases December 13. 308 petitioners of Homer and Seldovia should not be ignored. Purchasers of leaseholds should be advised that any legal actions may soon be instituted. To set aside any sale made without prior public hearing. Signed, Richard Robinson. And so the oil companies knew at the time of the sale that the leases they bought were tainted and might be illegal. Mr. Chairman and Madam Chairman, members of the committee, the actual conduct of the sale may or may not have been legal. That is for the court to decide, and that decision we hope will be forthcoming soon. But beyond that point is the moral obligation, the absolute responsibility of a democratic government to deal openly and honestly with its citizens on matters that so directly and so monumentally affect their lives. When I ask why, and you may remember this also, Senator Poland, when I ask the Commissioner Herbert at the time, why did you refuse the final petition of nearly 300 people calling for a hearing in Homer before the lease sale? The answer to me from the Commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources was, and I quote, those fishermen in their petition made no specific complaint. Now, to answer that way, to base your judgment on that fact, when the value or the importance of the fishery is known and we know that fishermen are concerned about an oil sale, to say they didn't make any specific complaint, that rather begs the credibility of all of us, I believe. Mr. Chairman, members, for a state government as a matter of public policy to initiate actions that may completely and irreversibly alter the lives of all the citizens of the area, and deny those citizens a voice in those actions is absolutely appalling, and as far as I'm concerned, must not be condoned. Well, thank you. And I might add that I wish that the people that were here for the House hearing from Homer, the herring season has started and they cannot be, but they were here and I think made very impressive statements on the value of that resource, the investigations that have gone forth, and the vulnerability, not only to the larvae, but the statement was made that at one time there were oil-covered oil deposits of some sort on the carabas of king crabs, adults that were taken to the processing plant in Seldovia. I know this is a fact. I was called. I went over there myself to take a look at it. I saw it personally. The reports that came back, even after those had been in the washing tanks of the processing plant, so that there was fresh water or clean water circulating constantly for over a week, Before those crabs were processed and then the meat was sent out for testing, the lab report came back that they were tainted, that they were unfit for human consumption, and I believe the material on the shell, on the carapace, was identified as hydrocarbons of some sort. To me, there was no doubt about it at all. Feeling it, touching it, feeling it, taking it off of those shells, there was no doubt that it was oil. They made very impressive witnesses, I believe. I'm sorry they're not here today. I don't know whether I've answered some of the questions or not, Senator, that you had, but again, I went into those hearings convinced, as I indicated, that oil and fishing have been and now still are compatible in Upper Cook Inlet, but I certainly came out of them completely convinced of the other as far as the shellfish fishery in Ketchikan Bay.
Representative Bob, a question to you, Chair. I gather from your testimony, Bob, that you'd be in favor of Senate Bill 7.1.
As I stated earlier, if this whole conflict can be resolved by way of negotiated arrangements, certainly. We did feel, I personally feel, well, in fact, the governor does also, whether it's practical at this point or not with this bill, I don't know. But we believe that the bill should contain two additional parts, not only the moratorium that I spoke of earlier, but if those things fail, then the power of eminent domain, after good faith negotiations, if such occur, have failed to produce a resolution to conflict, then it's important enough that eminent domain should be brought into play. Now, I recognize the situation here, I believe, so I did not bring that further at my original testimony, but I think the facts do warrant that. Thank you.
Senator Arsenio and then Representative Anderson.
What happens if we take no action on this bill and the Supreme Court rules that the suit is valid and that the lease sale is held illegally? What happens then?
If they were held illegally, the Supreme Court rules that? Well, then fine. We pay the companies back whatever price is determined, and I'm not sure whether a court master would get involved in that, where the court itself would set a value or how that value would be determined. But if it is ruled that indeed this process was illegal, then the leases will be null and void, and the state will be paying the industry some sum of money in compensation for it.
Supposing that does take place, are there any safeguards that the state feels are sufficient so that, at least from the protection of the shellfish resource, that they would again offer lease sales with those conditions, or are there absolutely no safeguards whatsoever that anybody knows about that will adequately protect the shellfish resource?
It is our feeling at this time that they do not exist. That Geyer area, and I do have some charts of that, it's been found by the department investigations the last 18 months, and I'm not sure whether National Marine Fisheries Service was involved in that or not, that something trapped in these whirlpools may stay as long as 20 days. Research does show that the microscopic in size larvae may stay on the surface as much as 4 months. If these platforms are in exactly that area, and permits are, and the leak does occur there, and those hydrocarbons continue in the whirlpool area, the gamble is simply too great. Yes, it's been said that the industry's been operating in Upper Cook Inlet for a number of years now, but there's also been several hundred spills recorded of varying magnitudes, as well as underwater breaking of pipelines and so on and so forth. And again, as recently as within a month or so, this defective valve, I believe it was at Trading Bay. Plus the fact that maybe we don't like to bring it up, but it still is a fact of life, that I think it was just last year that our Department of Environmental Conservation found that one of the major companies operating a petrochemical plant in the Cook Inlet area was found to be deliberately falsifying its figures that it was supplying to the state for the effluent discharge into Cook Inlet. They had a permit and allowed them to discharge effluent with certain concentrations of toxic materials. We found that they were deliberately keeping two sets of books, that the discharge rate was far higher than their permit allowed, and they settled, I believe, out of court not too long ago for something in the neighborhood of a $400,000 plus fine. My point is that regardless of regulations and enforcement, you can't have people on all platforms every day. There is a human error that can be involved. And again, there will be so much development, apparently, from Lower Cook Inlet that there is no rational reason at this time to simply enlarge upon that boom for a relatively short time rather than spreading it out, taking the federal lands now, maintaining the fishery for a period of time, and if it is later found that we really need the oil under Kachemak Bay and that the risk, the technology has developed far enough and the risks are something that we should accept, then it's certainly we can go ahead with it at that time.
What kind of liability, say there was platforms built, there is an oil spill, several years or 1 year or whatever of shellfish are wiped out. What liabilities do the oil companies have in this in that kind of hypothetical case?
I think it would be almost impossible to prove any, because the larvae microscopic in size would not be discovered, I believe it's safe to say. There are other organisms that apparently are not as vulnerable to hydrocarbons, and in all probability, many of the larvae, again, microscopic in size, would be ingested by those things. So I think proving what had happened in a court of law would be a practical impossibility. I've not heard any expert testimony on that, but that's my belief at this time.
What is the economic value to the state of 1 year of production?
Well, depends upon the prices and productivity, harvest from other...
I'll take this $7.3 million. Mm-hmm. What does the state get out of that?
I don't have those figures. Economists do tell us that these are new resource dollars and that they do turn over at least four times in the economy of the Kenai Peninsula. Now, that's first wholesale value. It's not to the fishermen. So the rotation would not be a full four on those. But it's not necessarily a one-year thing that we're concerned about. I think experience around the world has shown that it is not a single massive spill that is most important and most destructive. Instead, it's the small, chronic, day-by-day thing that can be occurring almost, well, on an ongoing basis. Certainly, that's one of my greatest concerns here, that the leak can be small enough, or the discharge can be small enough, that it seems to be inconsequential, and yet over a period of time, the overall impact can be very substantial.
How many parts per million can we detect? What's the lowest parts per million that we can detect that actually exists? Do you have any idea?
Well, I know that in this research they detected as low as 0.1 part per million. In fact, they found that some of the larvae were vulnerable to 0.1 part per million. Now, again, the Coast Guard says that it takes at least 10 parts per million before you can even see it visually as a sheen on the water.
Yeah, but certainly.
But microscopically, yeah. I mean, with chemical tests, of course, you can go lower than that. The question is, why would they be testing it unless there was some visual evidence that there was a need for a testing?
Well, I would assume that because it is such a vulnerable area and it's so sensitive that we have very frequent testing for that very reason.
Yeah. Hopefully. Hopefully we won't have to worry about it. Now, the federal people did recognize, at least to some extent, this concern and did pull back on the areas that they were going to lease near this area and moved offshore out into the center of Cook Inlet far enough so that the natural drift of a spill there would be to the westward and down south rather than into Ketchumak Bay. Far enough off that unless there is a strong westerly wind, a spill there would not come into this area.
Could you explain a little bit more of this whirlpool?
I have some charts here and I would be more than happy to give to you. Those are drogue current samplings that were taken at different dates and delineate the whirlpool in the area on those dates. It's about 6 miles in diameter apparently, but it changes in size from time to time as currents and tides and winds form. Apparently not too unusual in the marine waters of the world, but they are very, very large, maybe hundreds of miles in diameter, gyres in other parts of the world. But for some reason, apparently because of the, well, I won't speculate, but at least for some reason, the shellfish, mature shellfish, concentrate here to shed those larvae. They're dispersed throughout the water column, some on the bottom and many floating on the surface. And it's just the thing that completely makes Ketchumak Bay different from Upper Cook Inlet, where the only fishery of commercial harvest, apparently, is the adult salmon traveling through that central area of the peninsula. The juveniles are towards the edges, the shores of the inlet, and not through the more central regions where the platforms are. So to say that the industry has not caused any decline in that fishery up there, it may be, we don't know. But in any case, we're dealing with adult fish, adult salmon, not microscopic larvae.
Representative Anderson.
Madam Chair, I don't have any questions. Just wanted to point out to the committee that I have, as was earlier stated by Representative Rose, assigned the task of coming up with some kind of a middle ground on the issue. And Representative Rose seems to think that the bill has the potential for diffusing what I would consider a problem that makes a solution this session. And that we have indeed heard testimony from people who are on one side of the issue, and we are going to hold further hearings on April 9th from people who are very firmly convinced that
which industry provides the most jobs for those people now living on the Ketchumak Bay area, the fisheries or the oil industry?
Oh, very definitely the fisheries. There's no comparison at this point.
Do you have any rough figures, approximations, or as to the number of jobs?
No, I don't. There are some working on the platforms in Upper Cook Inlet. Leo, maybe you have.
I don't know, but I guess after I came out with that article in the paper about an Appalachian economy, I got some comments back on that, so I went over and rechecked the records, there's a population of that area about 3,000 in a month. I believe it was February, it was 400 to 480 people, which would be employable people, which would be about a third of or better, was either on welfare checks, relief, food stamps. The economy isn't that great in the wintertime, though.
Well, if we were to present the whole case, though, might we not talk about the so-called hippie commune out the East Road, which probably wouldn't be working regardless?
Well, I don't.
And I'm paraphrasing comments made by. I'm paraphrasing comments made by the Homerites.
I might say, though, these figures that I've hear over and over, where 6.2% of the area of Cook Inlet is in the Ketchumak Bay, the shellfish just produces that small area. I'm not sure, but maybe some of the folks from Kodiak unload in Homer, if that's counted as a Homer. shape, you know, in the Homer area. I'm not positive that, but where they say 65% of it is, comes into Homer area, or taken out of Kachemak Bay. Conceivably, some of that could come out of the Kodiak area, because those boats come in there to unload once in a while. But the 1973 figure of, I believe you said 7 million?
7.3 million for close in.
The figures they gave me down here was 5, but either 5 or 7 really wouldn't make too much difference, because they always use the 1973 picture as the value of the shellfish, because 1973 is when crab went climbed from 11 cents a pound to 85 cents a pound in 1973, so an 800% increase would really make a pretty good figure.
I believe it's also the time before the shrimp harvest had been developed, and it's still developing. So you didn't have the shrimp involved in it.
Senator Arsini.
As a follow-up to Senator Rody's question, what will be the employment once, or if this, if these leases were developed? Do you have any idea of that?
Well, I don't know, but I can recall the times when there was some earlier activity in that area, and one of the most frequent complaints that I heard at the time as a representative of that area was the complaint of the crews being brought onshore, being put directly on an airplane and flown back to Louisiana for their rest and rehabilitation. When that 10 days to 2 weeks was up, and they were paid out there, incidentally. When that 10 days to 2 weeks was up, then they were flown back up and put back out on the rig. I'm simply stating this is one of the most common complaints that I heard from the people of the area at the time. There are a number of people that are residents that are employed by the industry. There certainly is no doubt about that. And it does have valuable spin-off as far as the service industries, the service, the restaurants and the hotels and all the rest of it. Again, there's no doubt about that. But my point, and I think one of the major ones, is that we were still going to have that from development and those offshore federal leases. We can have both that and the fishery if we give the fishery this protection at this time. It's very possible that we will have only the oil, and you'll see a very drastic decline in the fishery if we do not give it this protection. Thank you.
The committee's wish on this. It has another referral to finance.
Madam Chairman, as long as we've got Leo Rode and Bob Palmer agreeing and Senator Tillian absent, so we don't even have to hear from him, I move that we send it on to finance.
Is anybody from the oil industry going to testify? Or
I haven't had any.
I see the number of representatives here. I thought they were.
Well, they're here to hear Mr. Gallagher, who will be speaking to us as soon as we finish this. You move that we put it out. Excuse me.
No,
put it out with individual recommendations.
Sure.
How many do pass? How many no recs?
No, I'm gonna go do not pass.
Then I think we'll take a 2 or 3 minute break here before Mr. Gallagher addresses us on the oil industry.